Oh my gosh. Okay. Bruchim Abayim. Thank you all for coming. I want to thank everyone for coming to this event, and I want to thank Ora for organizing this. She put a tremendous amount of work into it. As she mentioned earlier, and as I imagine she'll talk a little bit more towards the end, one of the things that's happened as we moved from our old location in Givat Shaul to this area here is we felt an opportunity to be involved with the broader community, and we've had a few events and adult education programs going on, and this is the first event of this scale, and we certainly hope it will be far from the last. So I want to just thank everyone who helped make it come together, and we hope that there'll be many more of these in the future. I did want to acknowledge my parents' presence and thank them for bringing me into this world 45 years ago today as the paratroopers were breaking through over in Brooklyn. I was being born, and I've had a tremendously powerful connection with Yom Yerushalayim ever since then. So thank you all. I also want to just acknowledge, she's not here now, but my daughter Batsheva helped me with the PowerPoint, so that's her. If we listen to the talk we heard just a few minutes ago, we listened to Dr. Goldflam describe, and I'm sure many of the people in the room don't need to hear it, but also remember from their own experience, as I just explained, I'm a little bit too young to know that.
Louder.
Louder, okay. I just want to block the screen. Can everyone see? Is that okay? Okay. If we heard the stories that Dr. Goldflam spoke about, and we put it into the perspective, and we think about the Hallel that we said this morning, I think it's absolutely undeniable that we're living in truly miraculous times. And things are changing just so fast around us that I don't think we fully absorb. In the words of Tehillim, "Beshuv Hashem et Shivat Zion, hayinu kecholmim." It's like we're in a dream. The redemption is happening literally all around us, and it's difficult at times to comprehend and to perceive of what's going on. But if we take a step back and we listen to the kind of stories we heard a few minutes ago, a few of our the Shana Aleph students, the young women that are studying here for the year, one of the activities we're running for them now is a walking tour where they're walking through the neighborhood here. Streets that they know very well, where they go, they do their shopping, where they sip coffee, where they go out to the dry cleaners, and hearing about tanks that were here just a few decades ago, and if we go further back, if we think about what was here 100 years ago, if we think about what was here in the times of Tanakh, David HaMelech fighting a battle in this very valley here of Emek Rephaim, and Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu Anavi, when he had to flee from the burning Jerusalem on his way to Egypt, went right down this road here, and he saw a city that was being destroyed in front of his eyes. Because he was a prophet, he certainly did envision a scene like this, where we're sitting here in a reunified Jerusalem. V'nivnita ir altila. The miracles are literally incomprehensible, and we have to try to, as we celebrate this day, to connect with it and to feel that sense of gratitude. As much as we have to feel gratitude for the rebuilding of the city and for the splendid metropolis that we are privileged to live in and to work in and to travel through, there is, of course, one site in this rebuilt city that remains in ruins. That's the very heart of the city. That's the site of the Beit HaMikdash, which we continue to pray for daily. Later on this afternoon, on the walking tour, when we're out on the Tayelet, of course, we'll be able to look right out there and gaze out at the site where, towering above the rest of the city, should be the Beit HaMikdash, and it's still not there. Of course, this is very difficult for us to relate to. None of us has ever been to the Beit HaMikdash. We don't know what it looks like. We don't know what the experience of being there is all about. We don't really understand what's so significant about this. A lot of it seems foreign to us, slaughtering animals, sprinkling blood. What's it all about? At the present moment, there's nothing we can do about that. Hopefully soon we will. But in the meantime, we cannot go and visit the site. But what we can do is we can understand it a little better by learning about it, by studying our sources that describe what this issue, what this entity is, what this Beit HaMikdash, what this temple is, and what its purpose is. And in doing so, I hope we can connect a little bit to the idea and to the longing for the Beit HaMikdash, for the final stages in the redemption that is unfolding in front of our eyes. I referred in the title, let me use this fancy thing I got here, Mishkan and Mikdash. I referred to these two terms which are sort of overlapping terms. At some point I'd like to try to work out the difference between the two, and I've been working on it for a while and haven't managed to work it out, so I'm not going to try to include that into this morning's shiur. But the term Mishkan comes from the word Shekhinah, a place of God's, where God dwells, and the term Mikdash, of course, from Kodesh, from holiness. And these two terms refer to different structures that existed at different points in Jewish history. And the truth of the matter is, why isn't this working? Technical problem already. Okay. The truth of the matter is that the concept of a Beit Mikdash is actually a mitzvah. There's a commandment, one of the 613 commandments in the Torah, to build such a structure. The Rambam, Maimonides, has an entire section of his Mishnah Torah called Hilchot Beit HaBechira, which is itself a very interesting term. The house of choice. Not the chosen house, not Beit HaNivchar, but Beit HaBechira, the house of choice. And he tells us right here in the first halacha, Mitzvat Aseh, it is a positive commandment, a commandment, an eternal commandment, one of the 613 commandments that is applicable at all times and in all places. Not in all places, at all times. La'asot bayit l'ashem mukhan liot makrivim bo hakorbanot. There's a mitzvah to construct a house of God, a place where it is possible to bring sacrifices. V'chogegim elav shalosh pamim b'shana. Sheneemar, and he quotes a pasuk, Vasuli Mikdash. That pasuk, Vasuli Mikdash, V'shachanti b'tocham, that pasuk is found in the book of Shemot, in Parsha Truma, in the context of the construction of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle that was built in the desert. And perhaps one could read that section and understand that it's referring to a specific commandment that was issued at a specific time and place. After all, the Jewish people had come out of Egypt, they'd received the Torah, they were on their way to the land of Israel, and Moshe Rabbeinu was given a commandment to collect all sorts of materials, b'yikhu li truma, to collect donations of gold and silver and tchelet and argaman and all sorts of things, in order to construct the Mishkan, the tabernacle that traveled through the desert with them, and which eventually was replaced with something else. One might have read that verse in the Torah, Vasuli Mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham, one might have read that and thought that this was a limited thing, something that applies at a certain time and place, and doesn't continue after that. But that's not how the Rambam understands it. The Rambam understands that this is a mitzvah taseh. That at all times there's a commandment to build such a structure if one doesn't exist. In other words, in theory right now, we're obligated to perform this commandment. Perhaps for halachic reasons, perhaps for external reasons, we're not able to. Perhaps we were just given something to think about maybe the problem is in our own thinking, maybe this is something we can be doing. That's not the topic of my talk for this morning. But whether it's practical or not, in theory this is an obligation upon us. As a nation, we have to build a Bayit Lashem Mukhan Liot Makrivim Bo HaKorbanot. And if such a place doesn't exist, we have to construct it. And the Rambam continues and tells us, Kvar Nitparesh BaTorah Mishkan She'asa Moshe Rabbeinu. The Torah tells us about the Mishkan that Moshe Rabbeinu built. And that was the fulfillment of this verse. But then he tells us something interesting. V'haya lefi sha'ah. The building that Moshe Rabbeinu built was temporary. It wasn't a permanent thing. It was never meant to last forever. We have an eternal commandment, Vasuli Mikdash, and the way in which that commandment was initially fulfilled was by building something that wasn't meant to last forever. It was meant to last for a certain period of time. And what was to happen after that? He tells us what happened after that. Kevan shenichnesu la'aretz hamidu hamishkan b'Gilgal 14 shana. The Jewish people entered the land of Israel from Gilgal in the area of the Jordan Valley near Yericho. Their campsite was called Gilgal, and they placed the tabernacle, the Mishkan that had gone through the desert with them, they placed that there, and it stayed there for 14 years. Umisham ba'u l'shilo, uvanu sham bayit shel avanim. Upersu yiriyot ha-mishkan alav, v'lo haita sham tikra. After the 14 years in Gilgal, the Mishkan moved to Shiloh. And in Shiloh it took a different form. That which they had in the desert was retired, it was put out of use, and a stone structure was built instead, a stone structure, but interestingly one that didn't have a roof. It only had curtains over it. It was sort of something in between a tent and a building. And it lasted there for 369 years. Shin Samech Tet Shana Amad Mishkan Shiloh. Until the death of Eli, as is recorded in the book of Shmuel. Correct. 369 years, that building stood there. But it was always considered a temporary structure. The first Beit HaMikdash only lasted for 410 years. But this one, which lasted for 369, not much less, was temporary in nature. Uchashemet Eli Charev Uval Lenov Uvanusham Mikdash Uchashemet Shmuel Charev Uval Givon Uvanusham Mikdash. After Shiloh, they built a Mikdash in Nov, and after that in Givon, two other cities in the area here. V'imei Nov V'givon Sheva V'chamishim Shana. Together, those all lasted another 75 years. Each Nov is a little bit north of Yerushalayim, in the land of Binyamin. Givon is west. So each of these structures, the Mishkan in the Midbar, the Mishkan in Gilgal, the Mishkan in Shiloh, and in Nov and Givon, were all fulfillments of this commandment, Vasuli Mikdash. And in the third halacha, he tells us, oh, there's a mistake here. I'll have to talk to the one who did this. There's a missing sentence. Actually, the mistake is mine. There's a halacha in the Ram. The next sentence, I think I must have deleted it. The next sentence tells us, unless I'm totally confused. One moment. Yeah, one second.
Is it there in the English?
Oh, that's a good question. Is it there in the English?
No,
it's the same thing. Okay. I believe there's another sentence, unless I'm confused. In any case, after this, of course, we came to Yerushalayim. Oh, I'm sorry. No, the sentence is here. I'm sorry. I just didn't read it. I'm totally wrong. She's right. I'm wrong. Ukeshemet Shmuel Charev Uval Givon Uval Shem Mikdash Umigivon Baal Lebeit Olamin. That's the phrase I wanted to focus on. After Givon, the next site of the Mishkan was in Yerushalayim. But here it's called Beit Olamin. Here it's called an eternal house. There's something interesting about that. We have a commandment, Vasuli Mikdash. That commandment was fulfilled first in the desert. It traveled through the desert. It was fulfilled in Gilgal. It was fulfilled in Shiloh and in Nov and Givon and then in Yerushalayim. But when it came to Yerushalayim, it's referred to as Beit Olamim. It's referred to as an eternal house.
Who refers to it that way?
The Rambam does here. And he tells us why in the next halacha. Kevan shenivna ha-mikdash b'Yerushalayim ne'esru kol ha-mekomot kulam livnot bahem bayit la'Hashem ulakriv ba'karban. From the moment that bayit, that house was built by David and Shlomo, here in Yerushalayim, barely a mile from here, from that moment, it became prohibited to ever bring sacrifices anywhere else and to ever build a temple anywhere else. From then on, the temple had to be brought there, built there and only there. The temple that was built in Shiloh and lasted 369 years was temporary. It was destined to eventually be destroyed and replaced. The building that David and Shlomo built in Yerushalayim would also be destroyed. But it was a permanent structure in nature. And when it's replaced with another structure on the very same spot. And only on that spot. And from that moment on, it can never, ever, ever move anywhere else. That is the halakha, that is the law.
Why didn't it go straight to Yerushalayim? Why did it have 300?
Okay, good question. Exactly. Let's think about that, okay? Where does this idea come from? Where's this law that once it comes to Yerushalayim, it can't go anywhere else? This is found, the source for this is found in Psukim, in the book of Dvarim. Okay? In the book of Dvarim, chapter 12, Eila chukim v'mishpatim, asher tishmerun la'asot ba'aretz, shenatan Hashem elokei avotecha lecha, etc. Moshe Rabbeinu is standing here at the end of the 40 years in the desert, as the people are about to enter the land of Israel. And he commands them, this is what's going to happen when you go into the land of Israel. Abed, whoa, that was not what I wanted to do. Abed to Abdun, destroy it. Kol mekamot asher avdu sham agoyim asher atem yorshim et Elohim al heharim haramim ve'al agvaot betachat kol eitzra anan. Moshe Rabbeinu says, when you come into the land of Canaan, the land of, what will be the land of Israel, you will find the place infested with pagan worship. Idolatry will be everywhere. V'nitatztem et mizbechotam, you'll find altars there. Destroy them. V'shibartem et matzevotam, you'll find monuments to pagan gods. Smash them. V'ashereihem tisrefun ba'esh, sacred trees that were worshipped. Burn them. Ufsilei Elohehem tegadeyun, you'll find pagan statues and idols. Cut them down. V'ibartem et shmam in amakom ahu. You have to cleanse the land and remove all vestiges of pagan worship from the land. And after that's done, lo ta'asun kein l'Hashem Elokeichem. Don't worship God that way. The pagans worship their gods, al heharim aramim ve'al hagvaot v'tachat kol eitz ra'anan. They built houses of worship on every street corner, on every hill and under every tree. That's not what you are to do. But rather, ki'im el hamakom asher yivchar Hashem Elokeichem mikol shivteichem lasum et shmo sham. But rather, there's going to be a place, hamakom asher yivchar Hashem, a place that God will choose to rest His name there. It is to that place, l'shichno tidrishu uvata shama. Seek out tidrishu, l'shichno. Seek out His dwelling place and go there. V'havetem shama, and there you shall bring olotechem v'zivcheichem, etc. Only to that place that God will choose in the future, may you bring your sacrifices. These psukim tell us that there's going to be a single place that will be chosen in the future. The location of this place was not known. It was not known during the first several hundred years in the time of Yeshua and the time of the Shoftim. In fact, if you read the book of Shmuel carefully, it's clear that even David did not initially understand when he first chose to capture Yerushalayim, when he came up this very road with his forces to capture Yerushalayim and chose to make that the site of his capital. He did not yet understand that this was to be Hamakom Asher Yivchar Hashem. Even when he brought the Aron to Yerushalayim, even when he laid the plans for building a Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, he did not yet understand that this was going to be Beit Olamim. David assumed, I believe, and if you read the Pesukim carefully, I think you'll agree with me, David assumed initially that what he was going to build in Yerushalayim would be like Shiloh, another large, impressive step towards the Beit Olamim. He didn't yet understand until the incident, which is recorded at the end of Sefer Shmuel Bet and in Divrei HaYamim, the incident in Goren Aravna, when an angel revealed himself to him, and only then did he understand that this was going to be the final resting place of the Shekhinah, of God's presence. So this mitzvah tells us that we have to do that. And then it says here, Lo tasun kechol asher anachnu osin po hayom, ish kol yashar beinav. Right now, Moshe Rabbeinu says, we can sacrifice to God wherever we feel like. And that's okay for now. We don't need one central place, one permanent location yet. Why? Ki lo batem ad ata el ha-menucha ve'el ha-nachala asher Hashem Elokecha noten lach. God explains, Moshe explains, we haven't yet reached the menucha and the nachala. We haven't yet reached that final place where our nation will settle down. We're not yet ready for the makom asher yivchar Hashem. So for now, at this point in history, Moshe Rabbeinu said, it's okay to have a traveling mishkan and to serve God wherever we happen to be. But, v'avartem et hayarden, v'yishavtem ba'aretz, asher Hashem Elokeichem anchil etchem, v'hiniach lachem mikol oyveichem misaviv, v'yishavtem betach. The day will come when you'll cross the Jordan, you'll settle into the land, and you will defeat your enemies, and you will dwell in peace and in security. And you'll be firmly established in your land. And then, and only then, Vayaha makom asher yivchar Hashem Elokeichem l'shaken shmo sham, shama taviyu. Then you will go to that place that God will choose. So here we begin to understand that on the one hand we had a mitzvah, v'asuli mikdash. Right after the Torah was given, one of the first things we were commanded was to construct a bayit l'Hashem, a house of God, a place where we can go to meet God, to offer sacrifices to God. And in its initial stages, it's going to travel with us. And it can be built in different places. And you can fulfill the mitzvah in the desert, you can fulfill the mitzvah in Shiloh, and in Nov, and in Givon. But there will be in the future a time when God will choose a permanent location. And that will only happen when Am Yisrael is ready. Lo batim arata al menucha v'nachala. At this point, Moshe said we're not ready. But once we get to the point of v'yiniach lechem mikol oyveichem misaviv v'yishavtem betach, once we reach that stage, and remember those words, we'll see them again in a minute. When we reach that stage, that we have defeated all of our enemies, and we're dwelling in peace and in security, then God will choose the place. In another location in the Rambam, in his Hilchot Melachim, he also discusses this concept. This is the very last section in the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, where he discusses the laws of kings and governments and wars. And he tells us, in the beginning here as well, Shalosh mitzvot nitzdavu Yisrael b'shat knisatan la'aretz. There are three laws that have to be fulfilled when the Jewish people enter the land of Israel. The three are, limnot lehem melech, we have to appoint a king, or at least some form of government. The exact question of whether what form of government and whether a king is the only form is a machloket. According to Rambam, it is. But we have to have a king or some form of government. Shenemar som tasim alech hamelech. Ulehachrid zaro shel amalek. We have to defeat Amalek, our arch enemy. Shenemar timched zeich amalek. Vilivnot beit habechira. And we have to build that house of choice. We have to build the house of God, the Beit HaBechira, the Beit HaMikdash, Shenemar, the Shechno Tidrashu Vata Shama. That's the verse that we saw in Dvarim a few minutes ago. So we have three laws that we have to do as a nation when we enter the land. Appoint a king, defeat Amalek, build the Beit HaMikdash. And these three laws have to be done in a certain sequence. They can't be done randomly. But rather, Minui Melech Kodim L'Milchemet Amalek. First, you have to appoint a king. And only then can you defeat Amalek. That makes sense. A nation that's not united can't fight a war. When we're a group of loosely associated tribes, we cannot face a national enemy. First, we need a king who's going to unite us together, and only then. And he quotes here a verse from the book of Shmuel. Oti shalach Hashem l'mashchacha l'melech, ata leich b'kita at Amalek. When Shmuel HaNevi anointed Shaul as the first king of Israel, that's exactly what he told him. Your primary mission is to defeat Amalek. It's for that reason that you're chosen. It's for that reason when he didn't fulfill the task that he lost his kingdom. Right? So and it was David who eventually defeated Amalek. So that's the purpose. First you have to have a king, then you can defeat Amalek. Ve'hachratat zera Amalek kodemet levinyan abayit. And only after Amalek and all the other enemies are defeated, only then can you go ahead and build the Beit HaMikdash? Shenemar vayhi ki yeshev ha-melech, ki yashav ha-melech beveito, ve-Hashem hiniach lo misaviv mikol oivav. This is how the Navi Shmuel describes, and Sefer Shmuel Bet, Sefer Shmuel Bet, how he describes the state when David said it's time to build a Bayit Lashem. He uses the phrase that's clearly referenced to that pasuk in Dvarim. Ve'hiniach Hashem lo misaviv mikol oivav. Only after God had enabled David to defeat all of his enemies. Now, they've reached the menucha and the nachala. Now the time has come. And therefore, Vayomer HaMelech el Natan HaNavi Anochi Yoshev beVeit HaRazim. That's when David turned to the prophet and said, you know, I'm living in a house of stone, and the Mishkan is still a temporary tent. It's not right. It's time to build a Bayit Lashem. So we have here this concept that there's a mitzvah, Vasuli Mikdash. That mitzvah, in its initial stages, can be fulfilled in any number of different locations. There has to be a spot, but it's not necessarily always going to be the same spot. And then there's a point in history, which was achieved in the time of David, when the Jewish people are settled and dwelling in peace and in security, then the Beit HaMikdash is to be built, then Hashem will choose the location, and at that point it becomes permanent. From that point forward, the Mishkan can never exist anywhere else. Temporary locations are phased out and forbidden forever. But if we look more carefully at these two sources in the Rambam, we'll see something else that's interesting. Earlier, we looked at the Rambam in Hilchot Beit HaBechira. We saw the mitzvah, the eternal mitzvah to build a Bayit Lashem. And now we saw in Hilchot Melachim the mitzvah that has to be done in one of these three mitzvot. He refers to the mitzvah of building a Beit HaMikdash here, and he refers to it here. But if you look carefully, you'll notice he quotes two separate psukim. When he wants to source the mitzvah of building a Bayit Lashem, Muchan Liot Makrivim Bo Korbanot, when he wants to tell us that there's a mitzvah to build a structure where God's presence can dwell and we can bring sacrifices, he quotes the pasuk, Vasuli Mikdash. But when he wants to talk about the three mitzvot that have to be done in sequence when we enter the land of Israel, he quotes the pasuk in Dvarim, the Shechno Tidrashu Uvata Shama. And here he calls it Beit HaBechira, and he doesn't speak here about Korbanot. It seems, and I heard this in a shiur when I was studying as a Shana Aleph student in Yeshivat Har Etzion 25 years ago, and I happen to remember it. One of the rabbis there of Yehuda Shaviv gave us a shiur, and he explained that there really are two separate mitzvot here. This mitzvah, Bayit Liot Muchan, Liot Makrivim Bar Korbanot, a functional structure that can be used to bring sacrifices, that mitzvah can be fulfilled in any number of locations. When we built the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, that was also fulfillment of this mitzvah, but it was also fulfillment of a completely separate mitzvah. L'shichno tidrashu uvat Hashem. To build a place where God's presence will permanently dwell. And what makes the Beit HaMikdash permanent and all those other structures temporary? Because although the Bayit was destroyed, God's presence has never left the Har HaBayit. It retains its sanctity. That is not true in those other locations. You can go to Shiloh, maybe some have been there, and they've even found the site where the Mishkan stood, and you can stand in what was once the Kodesh HaKodeshim. And it's very interesting, but there's no holiness there. But the holiness, God's presence that rests on the Har HaBayit, has never left. And it's for that reason that we're all drawn there. Many of us will go there perhaps this very afternoon with tens of thousands of others to pray at the Kotel HaMaravi, because we know that we're getting more or less as close as we can to that spot, and we're not allowed to go all the way up into the Beit HaMikdash, because what David HaMelech established there was not destroyed. The external structure was destroyed, and that has ramifications. But the house of God, the Makom Hashra'at Shechinah, L'Shichno Tidrashu, that remains forever. That's why it's called Beit Olamim. So right now, we don't have this. We don't have Vasuli Mikdash right now. We have to wait for the third Beit HaMikdash to fulfill that mitzvah again. But L'Shichno Tidrashu, the Beit Olamim, the permanent house of God, and His presence dwelling in one spot on this earth, that remains forever.
Before David built the Beit HaMikdash, was it there?
No. It was in Givon, it was in Nov, it was wherever it was.
But we had Jerusalem at the time.
David captured Jerusalem.
It was called
variously Shalem or Yavus. The city was here, and until the time of David, it was in pagan hands. It was a city of Yavusim. It was unable. If you read in the book of Yeshua and the book of Shoftim, the tribes were unable to capture it, and only David. We still don't even know how he did it. Managed to capture it, and renamed it Ir David, made it his capital, built his palace there. And then built the Aron, brought the Aron there from Givon and the rest of the Mishkan, and decided to build the Abayit.
And then he named it Yerushalayim.
It was named Yerushalayim already from earlier.
How exact is the spot need to be?
Extremely exact, especially the Mizbeach. One of the halachic issues with why it's not so clear we could build it right now is that you might need a Navi. You need a prophet to describe the exact spot of the Mizbeach. There are those that think we can build one now, but it has to be exactly in the right spot.
But doesn't Herod rebuild large parts of the Mikdash?
He did, in the same exact locations, though. He wasn't building on the site of ruins. He was building on the site of something that existed already. He expanded the mountain also. Now, how much more time do I have? Okay. What we can see from what we have discussed until now is that the Mishkan and Mikdash, the house of God, went through a historical process of development, one could even say evolution. At different points in history, the house of God was in various different locations. Sometimes it was built, at other points it was destroyed. Each structure also had different features to it. And ultimately, when arriving in HaMakom Asher Yivchar Hashem in Yerushalayim, it took on an entirely different character. It evolved from just the Mikdash to the Shichno Tidrashu to the Beit Olamim, to the Beit HaBechira. And the house that David built was eventually destroyed, as we said, and yet an aspect of it remained. A few years later, 70 years later, another house was built in that spot, initially a very, very small and modest one. It also went through several stages. We talk about the second Beit HaMikdash, but there really were several different structures. Those who came from Babylonia built a very simple structure. It was renovated later on. The Chashmonaim, who rededicated it in the event that we celebrate on Chanukah, changed it. And as was just mentioned, Herod, near the end, completely renovated it and turned it into something extraordinarily spectacular and magnificent, to the point that the rabbis, who didn't have a very high opinion of Herod, for very good reasons, still had to acknowledge Mi shelo ra'a binyan hordus, lo ra'a binyan yafeh mi'amav, that there was something incredibly beautiful. Perhaps it was the most magnificent structure in the world at the time. And it was also destroyed. And the mountain lays in ruins. There's a structure there now. Externally a beautiful one, perhaps, an historic one, but it's not ours. From our perspective, the Har HaBayit is in ruins. And we await the building of the third Beit HaMikdash. And yet, the Mikdash remains. The Mishkan remains. The Shechina remains. So there's a process of evolution and development. A historical process with ups and downs and peaks and valleys that the Mishkan goes through. From the moment that the Jewish people in the desert under the leadership of Moshe built the Mishkan, that house of God has evolved and traveled and developed. And the development of this structure, if you think about it, is very closely connected with the development of the Jewish people. And that's what I meant in the title of this talk when I referred to it as a window and also a mirror. Of course, the Mishkan and the Mikdash is a window. It's a place that we can go to peer out to the divine, to perceive eternity, to perceive infinity. And we can bring a sacrifice there, even if none of us has any idea what that really means. And even if we might even be repelled by the concept of slaughtering animals and sprinkling blood, it's something that's so foreign to us. But there's a way, there's a place that you can go and meet God. It's a window to the divine. But it's also a mirror. If we look at the Mikdash, we see ourselves. And if we examine the state of the Mikdash, we will see the state of the Jewish people. And in the final few moments that I have now, I want to show you a little bit about how this works. I want to look at a few of the structures that existed as fulfillment of this mitzvah at various points in history, and we know more about some of them and less about others. But I think if we look at the things that we know, we will see the evolutionary process of the Mikdash, and we will understand how it mirrors the evolution and the development and the progress of Am Yisrael. And I think at the end, we'll be able to look at the Mikdash as a mirror today and see ourselves as well. Let me show you what I mean. We'll start... Whoa, that's not what I meant to do. We'll start with the Mishkan that was built in the desert. This is an artist rendition. It was, of course, a temporary and a portable structure, as we mentioned. It was made out of poles and curtains. And that certainly reflects the state of Am Yisrael at that time. A wandering, nomadic people without a permanent existence. They need a house of God that can be picked up and carried with them, because that's the state of the Jewish people at the time. It was also a very simple structure. Here's a floor plan. The bayit itself, or the ohel as it was called, it was really a tent, not a house, consisted of just two rooms, an outer room called the Kodesh, the Holy, which had three vessels in it, the menorah and the shulchan. We have models over there of the menorah and the mizbeach, made by this year's students. We have a menorah and a shulchan and the mizbeach hazahav inside. And of course, in an inner room, the Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Holy of Holies, that's where the Aron was. Two simple rooms, surrounded by a single courtyard, which housed the Mizbeach, where the sacrifices were brought. It was also fairly small.
Meters?
Cubits. Amot. A cubit is about half a meter. Okay? So... The entire structure, the Mishkan itself, is 30 amot, that's about 15 meters, by 10 amot, by about 5 meters, roughly the size of my house, which is not very big, I assure you. Okay? It's two simple rooms, surrounded by a single courtyard, a single chatzer, and the courtyard itself is 100 amot, 100 cubits by 50 cubits. From there it went to Shiloh. We don't know the dimensions or the structure, the architectural plans of the building in Shiloh. The Tanakh mentions that such a building existed. We have no traditions about it. The archaeologists have found something which tells us something. And from what the archaeologists found, it was probably similar in structure to this. But we don't know the details of it. Other than, as the Rambam told us, it seems to have been something that was built on this model, but made out of stone, and yet without a roof. So clearly, more permanent, and it lasted 369 years, but still temporary in terms of its conceptual framework. But eventually, we come to the first Beit HaMikdash that was built by Shlomo. Here's an artist's rendition of that. The first Beit HaMikdash was roughly twice the size of the Mishkan, 60 by 20 by 30 amot. Again, divide it in half and you'll get the number, amount, the approximate amount in meters. And it had three rooms, not two. It had the Kodesh and the Kodesh Kodeshim. It's a little hard to see in this picture. But in front of the Kodesh, there was something called the Ulam, sort of like an entrance hallway. And that, I guess, gives it a little more of a feeling of grandeur about it. The first Beit HaMikdash was not as big as the second, as you will see. What you've probably seen are pictures of the second Beit HaMikdash, the Herod's building, which we know a lot about. We'll get to that in a minute. And it's unclear. It may have had two courtyards, not one. The second Beit HaMikdash, this artist drew it with two courtyards. That's how Rashi understands it. But it's not 100% clear. If you look in the book of Shmuel, Malachim Aleph, when it describes the building of the first Beit HaMikdash by Shlomo, it refers to the courtyard, the Chatzer, which has the Mizbeach in it, as the Chatzer HaPnimit, the inner courtyard, which seems to imply that there's an outer one, unless the Temple Mount itself was being referred to. The second temple certainly had an outer courtyard, so I'll talk about that in a second, and we don't know the dimensions in the courtyard. But there's definitely a development here. The building is larger, it has at least an extra room, and of course it's a permanent structure with a roof, and it lasted 410 years. When we get to the second Beit HaMikdash, the second Beit HaMikdash, here's a picture of the model that they have over in the Machon HaMikdash in the Temple Institute, and here's a floor plan of it. The second Beit HaMikdash, first of all, 100 amot long, 70 amot wide, and the front part at least was 100 amot tall, 50 meters tall. That's about 2.5 times the size of the Dome of the Rock, the height. So if you just want to imagine, when you go out there to the Tayelet later, just imagine the imposing structure that once stood there. Herod's building, correct. Herod's building, that's correct. We don't have much information about the earlier versions of it. Okay, but here, we again have the three rooms. We have the Kodesh Kodashim, the Kodesh, and the Ulam in front of it. We have it surrounded by the courtyard with the Mizbeach, just like in the Mishkan. But there's also an outer courtyard, which for some strange reason was called Ezrat Nashim. It's not only for women. Men can go there too, and women can sometimes go in here. But for whatever reason, it was called Ezrat Nashim. But the point is there's an outer courtyard. An outer courtyard which did not exist in the Mishkan, may or may not have existed in the first Beit HaMikdash, certainly existed in the second. What's the function of this outer courtyard? The inner courtyard, most of it, is accessible only to Kohanim. The very, very earliest, outermost area, what's called Ezrat Yisrael, can be entered by any Jew who's bringing a korban at that moment. You can enter to the very outer area of it just for the purpose of bringing the korban. Most of it is accessible only to Kohanim, and they're only allowed there when they're doing the avodah. They're only allowed there when they're doing the service. It's a very restricted area. Of course, the inner areas are even more restricted. But this inner courtyard is a very restricted area. Not so much this. You have to be pure, you have to be tahor, that's why we can't go up there today. But this is an area where the people can congregate. The Simchat Beit HaShoeva, for example, the great celebration on Sukkot, which is described in great detail in the Mishnah Masechet Sukkot, took place here. And to me, that's highly significant. This outer courtyard didn't exist in the Midbar. The initial Mishkan that was built, the initial Vasuli Mikdash, only had one courtyard. It was there for the Kohanim to enter. The people were camped around, but the Mikdash itself was basically off limits to them. But by the time we reach the Menucha and the Nachala, and we settle, and we have a permanent bayit, the Mikdash expands and has an area for all of us to go. The Jewish people are now able to enter the Mikdash because we're more a part of it. We're more connected with what's going on there. And that's highly significant. The second Beit HaMikdash was beautiful when we get to Herod's building. But it lacked some of what existed in the first Beit HaMikdash. Most significantly, the Kodesh Kodashim, where the Aron is supposed to be, was empty. The Aron was hidden at the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash and has not yet been found. It will only be revealed when we have a third Beit HaMikdash. So there was something beautiful about, in Herod's time, about the external structure. And it was a magnificent building. And by the way, parts of it are still standing. The Kotel HaMaravi was not part of the Beit HaMikdash. It was part of the complex that surrounded it. Robertson's Arch that you can see. It was such a magnificent structure that some of it at least has survived. And it reflected a nation. In the time of the Hashmonaim, a nation that was a powerful nation again. That had conquered neighboring areas. That was a major, major player in this region. And that was sought after as an ally by the Roman Empire. But on the spiritual level, there was something lacking. Most of the people remained in Galut. Most of the people didn't come back. By the time we get to Herod's temple, many of the people were involved with Hellenistic culture. And the inner essence of the Mishkan, the Aron, was missing. But still, it's a much larger structure. The two courtyards together, the Mishkan was 100 by 50. The two together, it's 135 wide. And the two together, 322. Much, much larger. And then this was also destroyed. And it was replaced, will be replaced, by the third Beit HaMikdash. And interestingly, we actually know a little bit about what the third Beit HaMikdash looks like from the Navi Yechezkel, who, in a very interesting passage in Perek Mem through Mem Gimel, was shown a vision where he sees the third Beit HaMikdash, and it's described in great detail with measurements. And you can draw architectural plans. Here's one attempt to do that, of the third Beit HaMikdash of Yechezkel. If we look at this, we find something that I believe is extremely fascinating. The bayit itself is the exact same size as the second Beit HaMikdash, at least the length and width. I haven't been able to figure out the height in Yechezkel. I imagine it was probably 100. But at least the length and width of the actual bayit are the same as the second Beit HaMikdash. And it has three rooms, Kodesh Kodeshim, Kodesh, and the Ulam in front of it. And in fact, there are two courtyards. There's a Chatzer Pnimi, that's what Yechezkel calls it, and there's a Chatzer Chitzoni, there's an outer courtyard. But if you compare these courtyards in Yechezkel's vision to the courtyards that existed in the second Beit HaMikdash, you'll find two fascinating differences. The bayit itself, the house itself, the three rooms, roughly the same size. The Chatzer Pnimi, the inner courtyard, roughly the same size with the Mizbeach. Here it's 100 by 100. In the second bayit, it was, I believe, 100 by 135, shaped a little differently, roughly the same size. But the surrounding areas. Yechezkel, the Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, in the second Beit HaMikdash, until Herod extended it, was 500 by 500 amot. In Yechezkel's vision, and don't ask me what this means in practical terms, I have no idea, but in Yechezkel's vision, the Har HaBayit is 3,000 amot by 3,000 amot. That's 1.5 kilometers by 1.5 kilometers. Wow. I don't understand what that means in practical terms. It's much of the old city. I don't know what that means in practical terms, and I don't know if it's meant to be literal or figurative or symbolic, but frankly, it's not relevant to the point I want to make. The Har HaBayit is huge, and the Chatzer HaChitzona, the outer courtyard, is also huge. 500 by 500 amot.
Those four,
right? The inner courtyard is here.
No, those little four squares.
These are outer chambers and offices that are in Yechezkel's vision. Okay? But look at this. The inner courtyard and the house itself are roughly the same size. The outer courtyard is much, 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 much larger. 500 by 500. And there's also something else.
The Mizbeach is much bigger.
In this drawing, it appears to be. It could be that it is. I haven't looked into that much. But I want to show you one other thing. If we go back for a second. In the second Beit HaMikdash, the outer courtyard was behind the inner courtyard. You enter the outer courtyard, and from there you go into the inner one, and from there to the bayit.
Where's the kotel over here?
The kotel is roughly down there. This is the western side. No, one second. I'm sorry. This is the western side. This is the western side. And the kotel is like around there. Somewhere over there. Down below. Okay? But in the second Beit HaMikdash, you enter the outer courtyard and then the inner one. If you look at Yechezkel's model, it surrounds it. And to me, that is so significant. Look at the Jewish people who started with a Mishkan. When they first got the command, Vasuli Mikdash, they built a temporary structure that didn't even have an outer courtyard. It was a house of God, yes. You could go there and bring a sacrifice, yes. But it's inhabited by the priests, by the Kohanim. The people are camped around. But outside. In the second Beit HaMikdash, and maybe in the first, they have a room at the back where they are able to go and have some connection. When we reach the third Beit HaMikdash that will be built when the Jewish people reaches the state of perfection in the Messianic era, the outer courtyard where the people gather is huge and massive, and they're not at the back. Not at all. They surround the Mishkan. Vasuli Mikdash Vishachanti Bitocham. I will dwell in their midst. And here you have the symbolic representation of that. That huge Chatzer Chitzona. That huge Harabayit, which the entire people can gather in. And they don't sit at the back as spectators, but they surround the Mishkan. And God's presence is literally in the center. That's the ultimate vision. And that's only possible when Am Yisrael is at the point that the Mashiach is able to come. And that's why the second Beit HaMikdash, Yechezkel's prophecy, was given during the period between the first and the second Beit HaMikdash. And I didn't have time to show it to you earlier, but that one of the Rambam's halacha, that was actually the next halacha, the Rambam explains that when they built the second Beit HaMikdash, they drew on some of Yechezkel's measurements and some of his descriptions. Part of it was possible then, but part of it was not. And particularly the Chatzer Chitzona, the huge surrounding areas with the Mishkan at the center, was not yet possible because we, Am Yisrael, were not yet possible. So when you look in the Mishkan and you look at it as a mirror, we see ourselves. And now in the last minute that I have, let's look in that mirror. Let's look at the Mikdash today. And let's see what we see about it, and thus about ourselves.
Only three gates.
There are indeed only three gates, that's correct. One on each side here, none on the western side. When we look at the Mikdash today, a Mikdash that, as I said earlier, still exists. God's presence still dwells there. And yet the site lays in ruins. Miracles happened there 45 years ago today. And miracles continue to surround it. Symbolically, if not literally. Yechezkel saw an expanded Chatzer Chitzona, an expanded Harabayit, and perhaps an expanded Yerushalayim beyond that. Look what we have. He spoke about a small village that was here. Dr. Goldflam, the small, what he called a small village, was itself a huge metropolis compared to the city built by David. And today, a city that's home to 800,000 people. Unfortunately, only 500,000 or 600,000 of them Jews. A city that's home to 800,000 people. The Chatzer Chitzona, the area surrounding the Mikdash, where all the people gather. And you can go on certain key moments. You can go later today. You can go next week on Shavuot. You can go at these times when the area surrounding Mikdash is packed with tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands, of Achenu B'nai Yisrael. And it's a city that pulsates with life. It's the capital of the country. And not only 4 days a week now. And it draws Jews from all over the world. It draws non-Jews as well. The outer areas surrounding the Mikdash have been built l'tiferet. But whereas the second Beit HaMikdash, we looked in the Kodesh Kodashim and found that empty. Right now, this entire thing is empty. The spiritual heart at the center, God's presence is there. But the ability to bring korbanot, the ability to approach it, to look through that window to the divine, that is what is still lacking. And so when we look in the mirror of the Mikdash today, We see the paradox of our existence. The Geulah, the redemption, is unfolding in front of our eyes and is already in advanced stages, and yet the Churban, the destruction, still exists. And this is the paradox. And this is the dichotomy of our existence. A few weeks ago, we observed Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzma'ut immediately in juxtaposition to one another, and I spoke to my students in this room about how difficult that is emotionally, and yet how it has to be that way. How profound it is. Because that is the nature of our existence right now. The redemption is literally at our fingertips. We've been brought to the threshold. The vision of Yechezkel is unfolding. And the Mikdash at the center awaits to be rebuilt. May it happen b'mehirah bi'yameinu, speedily in our days. Thank you.